Good morning. So now, equipped with the knowledge of special relativity, which we studied last week, we can actually proceed to relativistic field theories. And so today I would like to give you some general picture and some general properties of these things. And then tomorrow we will discuss Maxwell theory and beyond Maxwell theory. So, okay, so part A will be action principle. And so when we discuss relativistic field theories, we really talk about fields. So relativistic fields so I'll be writing a scalar field phi, and so the scalar field or whatever is a function of both space and time, right? So this will be a function of t and also x. So we know electromagnetic field, that's more complicated field, but you know, so relativistic fields, phi tx, so they live in space-time, and they also behave nicely under the Lorentz transformations. Or more generally, by Poincaré transformations. So of course, you can also consider non-relativistic field theories where you know you still will have your field, which is a function of time and space. But you know then you know it has nice properties under something else than Lorentz transformations, okay, and that's fine. So you can have non-relativistic field theories, or you can have some weird field theories, and so on. All right, and so of course we start with an action. We are now two experts on action. So instead now, action is not a function of trajectories, but it's a function of the field. And it's simply given by the integral over some space-time domain omega. And then we have dt and then d3x, or we can just write d4x. And then there will be some Lagrangian density, which is a function of phi, and then d mu of phi. Okay, so again, you want your Lagrangian to depend on field itself and its first derivatives. If you start going to higher derivatives, then you will have higher order equations of motion. Okay, and so similar to the particle, we just vary the action. So this is a space-time domain. So really, you know, we have t and we have x. And there's some omega, some bounded region in the space-time. And the bounded region will have some boundary, which we will call d omega here. And so, of course, in order to formulate the action principle, you prescribe some data, what's happening on the boundary of the space-time region. So for example, you fix the field on this boundary, and then you vary the action is that boundary condition with fixed endpoints, if you want. And then we get the equations of motion from here. So let's do that. So we have delta S is equal to 0. That's the action principle. And then it's the same kind of variation as we did for the particles. So this variation delta leaves the space-time untouched, but it varies only the fields. So if I fix the point in the space-time, and I allow for some fluctuations of the field in that space-time point. So that's why the delta only acts on L and doesn't act on the d4x or whatever. And then we just do it as we did it for particle. So it's dl over d phi delta phi plus dl over d mu phi. delta d mu phi, and then d 4x. So you just vary with respect to both. And so because the delta does nothing to do, has nothing to do with the space-time, I can again swap the two. So delta now commutes with my derivatives, with my partial derivatives. I can swap the two. So this is the same thing as d mu of delta phi. And then I integrate by parts, as we did for particles. Again, a divergence theorem or something like that, but it's an integration by parts, right? So we just move this d mu on this guy here, picking up a minus sign. So this is equal to an integral over omega dl over d phi, and then picking up minus sign d mu of dl over d mu phi. Okay, delta phi plus a boundary term.
David, I've got a question.
Yes.
In the interviews, will you ever ask us why we can switch like the delta and like the derivative? Because I've been worried about it, but I don't really know why. Is that a fair question or not a fair question?
It's a fair question. But you know, the answer is simple, because I told you it's so. Because, yeah, that's right. Okay. Because, really, you know, this delta, I fixed the space-time point here, and I just, you know, consider the fluctuations in that point, right? Or, you know, in case of the particle, you know, this is q, so the delta q goes in this direction here, right? And so the time is fixed in this delta q. So you know, the d over dt, you know, is perpendicular to that. It's nothing to do with doing the variation in delta. But, you know, that's just hand waving. And, you know, if you define properly what this...
That's a four derivative.
This one here, yeah. Well, you can think about t and x now as basically what you had t in case of the particle, right? So the trajectory of the particle is characterized by time. So wherever I'm on the trajectory is specified. Well, I specify time and I know where I am. Right, so when I talk about the trajectory at a given time, so really, okay, and here I'm talking about the field at a given space and time, right? So really, you know, going from field to, you know, from particle to field theory, the correspondence is very simple. So here we had a trajectory, we go to the field. Here the trajectory was parameterized by time. Now we parameterize by time and space, right?
Okay.
So this x has nothing to do with that q, okay? The field here is the field, well, the field here in, you know, zero plus one dimensional thing is just the q, right? So this is the field, and that is just a label which tells me, you know, where I am thinking about my field. Or when, where and when I'm thinking about the field.
So the x vector is still, like the position vector, it's still like kind of orthogonal to our, I guess, field if we were to plot it?
Exactly. Okay. So you just, you know, what you do is that you, well, it's harder to imagine, right? But you fix the space and time point, right? You fix it, and then you just consider variations of the field in that space-time point. And that has nothing to do with, you know, the directional derivative of or time derivative of whatever, the fluctuations in that field, is like I'm considering two different field configurations at that space-time point.
Okay.
Right? But anyway, so if you don't like this explanation, then just go to the proper definition of what this delta means. Right? So it's a variational derivative, and you will see that the variational derivative is really, you know, it's calculated a certain limit, which has nothing to do with the time derivative or space derivative or something like that. You just, you know, define your field phi, you define your s at phi plus, I don't know, epsilon times something, plus delta phi, and then minus s of phi. Again, I'm using this stupid language. And then, you know, there's nothing to do with space and time. So this is basically a variational thing, right? And yeah, okay. Just you know, just fool around as I am here, and that will be fine, okay? All right, and then we have a boundary term. And the boundary term, so there will be an integral over d omega, and then it's just dl over d mu phi delta phi, and now it will be d3x, whatever that means, is just an integral, it's a boundary term, like what happens on, you know, on that boundary of space-time omega. Okay, is this correct? Is the sign correct? I have a minus there. Okay, so this wouldn't be a vector equation. It's not nice. So we also have to put a normal here to that boundary. So this is, and then typically people just call this d sigma mu d three sigma mu or without three. So this would be like a boundary element, right, which has certain normal to that. Okay, very good. So now let's say we fix the fields on the boundary. So we say delta phi on d omega is zero. So if it's a fixed endpoints or, you know, boundary data, how do we call that? So anyway, we impose delta phi on d omega equal to zero. That's whatever the fixed endpoints were before. And so then the boundary term does not contribute. And it's simply zero, right? If you, it would be like fixed endpoints. Okay, and if that is true, so boundary time is gone, this has to be zero, but it has to be zero for all variations of delta phi inside omega. So the only possibility is that this thing here is equal to zero, which is the Euler-Lagrange equation for the fields. So we have dl over d phi minus d mu dl over d mu phi equals to zero. And that's our Euler-Lagrange equation for field phi. Yes.
What's the thing after d3x?
This thing here, and mu. Yeah. So that will be the normal of the boundary, right? So the boundary. Well, if this is a space-time region, right? So this is a 4D space-time, right? So now the boundary is three-dimensional boundary. But as always, this anything which, you know, surrounds some region, you can assign to it a normal, right? So now I don't know, I may be choosing the wrong normal. You can either choose inwards or outwards, doesn't matter. You just have to stick to your convention. And so this is the n mu, the vector which points out, you know, outward everywhere, right? So then the volume element on this boundary, you know, contains not only, you know, d3x, but also contains, you know, the information about the normal. Yes?
When you say d3x, does this mean that the surface is like a time slice?
It does not have to be, right? It can be. So typically what you will do is that, well, this is my time and space, right? But typically what you will do is that you will choose some nice boundary. Let's say the boundary which looks like this thing here. So in this piece, you just move in time. That's your boundary. In this piece, well, so this piece is, you know, it will be, let's say, sphere at infinity, right? So sphere at infinity, I just, you know, let the sphere there, and it will just, time will click, and the sphere is sitting there, right? So this would be the boundary, which is time-like boundary, and then, let's say, a sphere, right? But then this would be a space-like boundary, where I fix time and say, you know, this is you know, my t equal to constant slice of my universe. So that would be that boundary, right? And so omega in general will have, you know, it better be smooth. It doesn't have the corners like this. Well, you don't like corners anyway. But anyway, so it can be any boundary in space-time. And mu in principle, you know, doesn't have to be time-like or space-like. It can change the character over Yeah, does that answer your question? Yes.
When we're doing the variation, we almost always consider Dirichlet boundary conditions.
Yes.
The variations boundary. Is there ever any case where we consider the derivative of vanishes?
You can consider anything you want, right? As long as you prescribe the right amount of boundary data, then it's okay. So some, you know, you can do Neumann boundary conditions, or you can do mixed boundary conditions.
How would we implement this in the?
Typically, people just start adding. So you know, your theory, right? Is characterized by some Lagrangian, right? And so the variational principle basically tells you what do I need to prescribe for the given L, you know. Requiring that this is equal to zero gives me that, for example, if I do it here, I better have delta phi equal to zero on the boundary, because this integral has nothing to do, cannot be balanced by this integral here. This is a bulk integral. I have arbitrary delta phi here. So you know, this thing here has to vanish separately to the boundary term, right? So now we have found that if we choose it like that, you know, we better choose, for example, delta phi is equal to zero on the boundary. But now you can start adding boundary terms to your action, and then you can artificially prescribe different boundary conditions. Let's say I start with a, you know, boundary term which you know kills this thing here, but then which has a derivative on the field, and so you can do that. And so you will see that, for example, the Einstein-Hilbert action is really, really bad for gravity, because it, you know, it requires both. You need to prescribe delta phi on the boundary, but you also need to prescribe d mu of delta phi on the boundary. So that's really bad. But you can upgrade that action to either, by adding a boundary term, to either consider the Dirichlet problem or Neumann problem or whatever problem you want. So just, you know, you keep adding some boundary terms, and that makes your action from one to another. More questions? OK, so we have the beautiful Euler-Lagrange equations. Of course, this thing here would still work if the field phi had some index, right? If you had electromagnetic field, vector potential, let's say, then I can happily put the index here, whatever the index has to be. Let's put it A here. And then, you know, you would just have more Euler-Lagrange equations for any index A, whatever A takes, OK? So you would have more Euler-Lagrange equations if you had some extra degrees of freedom in your field. OK.
Can you refer to extra degrees of freedom in this? If we had like multiple fields, like if we had a phi field and like a theta field,
if your action depends on more fields, then you have to vary with respect to all fields separately, right? So then you would vary your action with respect to field phi, but with also with respect to field a mu or with respect to g mu nu or whatever. And again, you know, these typically are in, variations are independent, but you can do the variation like all the fields. You can put them here. And then you just get many, many more Euler-Lagrange equations, one for each field, basically.
If the fields be the covered function, if we have interaction term, then it should change. If we have interaction term or coupling term between the fields that should change, you mean?
That's right. Well, you will see that tomorrow, OK? But you still vary with, let's say I have interaction of, I don't know, phi and a mu, right? So that would be like scale electrodynamics, right? So then I vary the, and that can be an interaction term. There can be, you know, j mu. There can be a current corresponding to phi, and that's how your scale electron would interact with a mu, right? So then, well, it doesn't matter, right? I still vary with respect to delta phi. I vary with respect to delta a mu, and then my final equations already know about this interaction, because of course the interaction term depends on both fields, and so it will show up in these equations here. More questions? This is fun.
What's an example of, like, if it's just extra degrees of freedom, like, what do you mean by that? Like, would we?
Oh, precisely that your field phi can carry some index, for example. Okay. Your field phi can be vector potential a mu, okay. Or it can be a metric, g mu nu, or whatever. So that would be, you know, like an extra index here. OK, so if you know, this was metric, you would just put g alpha beta here. And you would put g alpha beta here. And then, you know, of course, you know, this equation, well, what it would give you, well, this alpha and beta goes from 0 to 3. And so it would give you 10 equations for, you know, G00, G01, G02, and so on. Mm-hmm. It would get 10 equations. So by the way, similar to the freedom which we had for the particle, so we have the freedom L plus d lambda over dt. That was our freedom. So similarly, we have that we can go from Lagrangian plus d mu L mu. Well, this is some vector L mu, which depends only on phi, but not only on its derivatives. So here, what was important is that this depended only on q, but not on q dot. So similarly, this is the freedom. In description. So you can, you know, start adding these things and the equations of motion will not change. They will remain the same. Okay, so now we understand field theory, we understand the equations of motion. Conserved charges. Okay. We're just playing the same game as we did for the particle. But you know, it's very, very similar. So conserved charges or currents, doesn't matter. I put currents. And so we have Noether's theorem, the same thing as for the particle applies. So let me just list this one version, the explicit version, because you know it's useful to have explicit expressions for some currents. So let's put Noether's theorem. And again, you know, explicit version. So the implicit one would be whenever you have some symmetry, global continuous symmetry, you will have conserved current and hence called conserved charge, but whatever. Explicit. So let delta tilde, again, it's a different variation than this one. Now I can vary space-time points as well. Be a global continuous symmetry. Returning back to our first lecture, right? That is off shell. We find delta tilde of x mu, so we can change coordinates, and we can change fields as well, such that the action does not change. So that's what you mean by global continuous symmetry. So let's assume that we have found this. We are given the action, we place the action, we find, you know, such transformation of x mu, such transformation of phi, so that this is true. Without using equations of motion, we just, you know, look at the action and we see it. Then we find a conserved current. We have the following conserved current. J mu. And this J mu will have two contributions similar to what we've seen for the particle. And it's given by E mu nu. And there is a subscript C standing for canonical. So this will be energy momentum tensor, T mu nu, but the canonical version for that. Delta tilde X nu plus dl d d mu phi delta tilde phi.
I'm sorry, is that the new lower index, but the c is a subscript?
Okay, very good. So I'll tell you, okay. So this is called a canonical energy momentum tensor. So the C here stands for canonical. The reason why you need to distinguish is that you have 101 different energy momentum tensors, and they can be different. So that's why it's important to stress here that we constructed this guy from the Noether's procedure, and the corresponding energy momentum tensor is called canonical energy momentum. Okay, so the or you could say Noether's energy momentum tensor, whatever. But people say canonical. Okay, so we have the following concept, KMJ mu, which is this thing over here. So it is conserved, which means that G mu, J mu equals to zero. So it obeys the continuity equation. And where this T mu nu, where this canonical energy momentum tensor is given by the following formula, T mu nu canonical equals to eta mu nu, the original Lagrangian, minus dl d d mu phi delta nu phi. Okay, so that's your prescription for the canonical energy momentum tensor. Okay, so that's the Noether's theorem. So it is again constructive and non-constructive. It is constructive in the sense similar to the particle is that, you know, once we find this delta tilde x mu and delta tilde phi, there is a procedure how you can derive that this is your conserved current. Conserved means this thing here, okay? That d mu j mu equals to zero. Yes?
Should there be delta tilde?
Should there be delta tilde where?
On the current momentum
tensor.
So there is delta tilde x nu here. And there's delta tilde phi.
In the canonical.
Here. Oh, no. So here, the T mu nu, so it's an object with two indices, mu and nu. Right? It's a tensor, space-time tensor. And then you have eta mu nu L. And then just vary L with respect to D mu. So that gives you one index mu. And then you just, D nu phi.
Oh.
Okay, so you just do a partial derivative. Phi, thank you. Thank you. Okay, very good. Sorry for that. So that's a partial derivative with respect to x nu, right? So you have to get a second index somehow. And so this is how you do it, d nu phi. Okay. So derivation of this goes exactly the same way as you did for the particle. Okay? Yes?
There's a lot of questions today. okay, so the global continuous symmetry, right? So we've got a variation with respect to x mu and a variation with respect to phi.
Mm-hmm.
Usually for global, it means like the things you're varying with respect to don't change.
So remember, we parameterize our transformations or whatever by some parameter epsilon or whatever. And then if the epsilon was a function of time for the particle, then we said it was local transformation. Oh. If it was a constant, we said it was a global one, right?
Okay, so these are not functions of time, x mu and phi.
So you know, there'll be some parameter characterizing your symmetry, you know, how much of the symmetry I'm doing if I'm doing rotation everywhere in the space-time, for example, right? So if I'm doing the rotation, which is everywhere the same in the space-time, it will be a global symmetry.
Okay.
If, you know, it has to vary from place to place, I do rotation by 100 degrees here, but I have to do by 50 degrees here and by 20 degrees here, so that would be a local.
How would we denote a local symmetry then? Like, here instead of a global symmetry?
No, no, no. So there's, you know, some parameter epsilon. And so either this epsilon is a constant, and that will be a global symmetry, or it is actually a function of space-time coordinates, and that will be a local symmetry.
How does epsilon like explicitly relate to delta x mu and delta phi?
Oh, very good. So yeah. So that will be, remember, so when we wrote this thing here, we wrote, let's say, delta x mu was some epsilon saying, you know, what we are, how much we are rotating or whatever, and then times the generator. So, you know, so this delta x mu, for example, would be written as epsilon times the generator x mu, whatever. So this would be your parameter, which says, you know, so it is contained in this delta x mu and in this delta tilde phi. It's exactly the same as we did for the particle, okay? So now there's so many things here.
Why do we call it canonical?
I don't know where the name comes from, but it's simply just to stress that it's the one which comes from the Noether's procedure.
Not with canonical transformations or physical meaning.
Yeah, I'm not sure. It's an interesting question. I never thought about it. For me, it's just a name. Because, as I said, there's many more other energy momentum tensors. Was there a question?
Where was the off-shelf thing used?
No, it's just whatever you mean by symmetry. So if you can find that, you know, this thing here leaves the action invariant without using the equations of motion, then you have a symmetry. Okay. So you know, once you have a symmetry, the statement is, then this thing here will be conserved on shell, or d mu, okay, mu on shell. And it wouldn't be a symmetry. It would be something that, you know, you have to use the equations of motion for, and then you wouldn't have conserved charge, literally. Okay, so let me just do one remark. And the remark is that, you know, if you remember what we have done for the particle, we had a very similar expression for, you know, this j mu or whatever. In that case, it was a, you know, integral of motion, and the integral of motion was dl over the q dot delta tilde q, and then plus L minus Q dot DL DQ dot delta tilde T. Okay. So this was the expression for the particle. And we know that this thing here is something like conserved energy. So now if you look at, you know, what's happening here, you see an exact parallel. Well, I should have written this term second, but anyway, you see an exact parallel between this thing here and this thing here. So this is something like conserved momentum, right? So here you have something like conserved momentum. The only difference is that now your q is phi, so it does not depend only on t, but also depends on other. So I just have to promote q dot d mu phi. Okay, so this would be like a conserved momentum term. So that piece corresponds to this piece. And then whatever stands in front of the variations of the coordinates, in that case, it was just delta tilde t. So now it becomes delta tilde x nu, right? We have more coordinates. We just have t and x, right? And so we knew that whatever stands there had a meaning of energy, right? So this object here, the canonical energy momentum tensor, where it contains some information about energy, right? And indeed, if you just take a T00 component of that, it will be your energy density, okay? So you can see exact parallel between, you know, the things. You are just adding one more index to the field Q. So instead of just Q as a function of time, you have Q as a function of all space-time coordinates. And so wherever you see dot, you just have to promote d mu, right? But otherwise, it's the same thing. Okay, Just remember this parallels, it's quite nice. Okay, we could go through the proof of this, but I will leave that up to you, okay? It's exactly the same as what we have done for the particle. The procedure is exactly the same. There's no more difficulties, basically. So if you are interested, just read the notes. But let's discuss some implications of this. So the first thing is that, well, I said, well, let us theorem that there better be conserved charge. But instead, I am giving you a conserved current. Right? I'm saying you this guy here will satisfy the divergence equation. Of course, we all know already that if you have continuity equation, there is some corresponding charge which is conserved. You just decompose your, as we have been doing before, you decompose your j mu into the rho and j part. And then if you integrate the rho part, you some kind of charge density, you integrate over volume, you get the charge. Right? So we have done that in the 3D notation, and it's simple. So now let's do it without splitting it into these things. Okay? So charge conservation. And let's do a covariant version. Version of defining charge to be integral rho d3v, where we split j mu to be rho and j. So this is what we have done before. You said, well, let's split my j mu into rho and j. Let's integrate the rho over some volume, and that better gives me charge, which does not, which remains the same as long as there's no flux through the boundary of my space. Right? So
variant.
Okay, so what I'm going to do now, okay, very good. So this is the old way. That's the 3D version of conservation of charge, right? And so then you have to show that dq over dt is equal to zero, provided no flux flux through the boundary of that, you know, volume region, right? So this is what we have done before. Let's now do a covariant version, meaning we will not be splitting j mu into rho and j. We'll just keep the index mu there, so that it's nice and covariant and valid in general relativity as well. Okay, and so the covariant version is even simpler and nicer in some sense. So what you just do is that, well, you have conserved charge, g mu j mu equals to zero. Okay, you just integrate that over some space-time volume here. Okay, so what we do is that we have zero equals to integral over some space-time domain of d mu j mu d4 of x. Right? Because d mu j mu is zero, if I integrate that over space-time volume, I still get zero. Okay. So now you use the divergence or Gauss's theorem or Stokes' theorem, whatever. So you kill this derivative, put it here. Okay. So it's an integral of d omega j mu. So again, we are still thinking about the same picture, right? So we have omega, we have d omega, this is space-time, e and x, right? And so then there will be a normal to this and mu. So then there will be d sigma mu will be the boundary, the volume element on this boundary, the three-dimensional volume element as we had it before. Oh, I see. Now I have done a big mistake. Okay. Anyway, okay, let's call it d sigma mu.
What's
the mistake? I'll tell you. So now this would be generally true, right? But now you choose the boundary, which I was talking about. You choose a boundary to be square. Rather than the general boundary, just choose a boundary which looks like this. We need this. So let's just choose a boundary that at some t equal to 0, we have slice sigma t 0. And then we have a boundary at some later time t. So there will be sigma t. And then we have a boundary which goes time like here. How did I call that? B. And similarly here. Okay, so I'm choosing this, you know, square boundary or whatever. So this is my region omega. D omega is this thing here, but here I travel only in time. Here I travel only in time. Here I travel only in space. Here I travel only in space. Okay, so this is for t equal to 0 slice, t equal later slice. Okay, so in other words, my boundary now consists of four terms. B here, B there, sigma t, and sigma t 0. Okay, so I have four terms. Let's group those for the boundary together. Doesn't matter whether we are here or there. Okay, so then we will have an integral over the boundary, j mu. Let's call it boundary mu. Okay, that's that. Then I have an integral. So what is important is the normals you choose. Okay, let's choose the normals which go like this, like that, and then up there. That, so that's your normal. So now you have to keep a convention when you do these integrals. If I choose the bound, the normals going like that, let's say if the normal goes inside the region, I'll take plus. If it goes outside of the region, I will take minus. Just a choose. You know, once you orient things, you can do the other way around. Doesn't matter. Yes.
Yeah, just to clarify, the sigma t and like sigma 0, those are the space-like ones.
Exactly. So this would be a space-like region. Space-like region. This would be a time-like boundary. So this is a space-like boundary. And so the space-like boundary is really I choose. You know, I take my universe. I take t equal to 0 slice. And so I see space around me. And that's precisely what sigma t 0 is.
Why are we allowed to arbitrarily set boundaries?
Well, you can consider more general space-time region than this. But why not to consider this one? It's a nice one. And so what you do here is that you place your boundary at infinity. Okay. So you know, so there's some radial coordinate going, let's say I have r equal to 0 here, then I go to r to infinity here to the boundary. I go with r to infinity to the boundary here. So then what's really sitting here, at this point here, will be like a sphere at infinity, right? And so that sphere at infinity just sits there in time, and as it sits there in time, it sweeps this boundary here.
So just because we're kind of considering like an infinite space-time, like we can choose
anything. Yeah. Or you. So typically, you want your boundary to be at infinity. How you do that? Of course, you regularize it. You say I set it to at r equal to capital R, right? And then you are taking limit capital R goes to infinity or something like that. But typically, you know, you get some whatever. So you want to regularize everything, and so may make the boundary at finite place. But then, of course, what you are interested in is the infinite space time, basically.
Sorry, did you, for the sign convention for the normals, the inwards one we're taking to be positive dimension?
Yes.
The outwards ones are negative?
Yeah.
Does that not depend on which way around you're going, though? Like, if you go around a different way, it'd be different?
Yeah. So what you are doing here, exactly. So you know, if I go like that, you can make choice whatever you want, right? But you have to stick to your choice. For any calculations, you just You can say hours count plus with the, you know, the normal going inside or outside, doesn't matter, right? But once you make the choice, it's inside, then you have to stick to your choice. And then as you go around, yeah. Okay. So this is my convention. So, you know, what I'm trying to say is that this guy comes with plus because it's going inside. This guy comes with plus. This guy comes with plus. But this guy, the normal is outward, so it will come with a minus sign. Okay, so we have integral over the boundary plus integral over the sigma t0 of j mu d sigma t0 mu. And then we have a minus integral sigma t j mu d sigma t mu. Okay, so we have these three terms. But this minus comes from the fact that the normal now goes the opposite direction. Okay. Oh, very good. So now this is equal to zero. Still, we just use the divergence theorem. So as long as there is no flux through the boundary. So as long as, you know, things don't go through this boundary here. Which means if this guy is zero, there is no flux through the boundary, then integral over sigma t0 k mu d sigma t0 mu is the same as integral over sigma t k mu d sigma t mu. Right? If there is no flux through the boundary, and this equals to that. Yes?
Do we have a factor of 2 on the B integral?
You can put it there. It's 0 anyway. Yeah, I said, yeah, sure. Okay, so this equals to that. So what it means is that whatever I calculate by this integral here on this slice will be equal to whatever I calculate at some later time on this slice. Okay. Well, that's good. So that means is that whatever that is here equals to that is there, it's a conserved charge. Okay, so we can call this to be Q, and that will be conserved in time. So in other words, this is the same, basically, it's a different argument than the three-dimensional one, but of course the content is the same, right? As long as there is nothing flowing through my boundary, there'll be some conserved quantity. The conserved quantity was rho d3v, but more generally, it can be written nicely covariantly in terms, you know, without splitting into rho and j, as an integral over j mu over some, you know, time equal to constant slice or whatever, right? So of course, this thing here better reduces to that thing over there. And it indeed does if I really choose t equal to constant slice, if t equal to constant slice, whatever that means, so then my normal will just be 1, 0, 0, right? And so this thing here is d3x normal. So it will just pick up the jt component of here, right? So then in that case, our q is just integral of jt d3x, but jt is what we called rho, right? So if I really choose slice like that, and I adapt my coordinates, that the normal is given, you know, there is no normal in the x direction, it's just in the time direction, then it just reduces to whatever what we know. But of course, this is more general. I don't need to do this. I can use any coordinates. I can consider normals. I can consider space-like surfaces, which you know have the normal has some components in the x direction as well, and whatever. I can consider deformed surface as long as you know. So this is more general and covariant way of writing it. Okay, question.
How did you say that the integral over the boundary B is zero?
You have to assume that, right? It's the same assumption as you know, in this argument. You have to assume that no charge, nothing is going to infinity, no current, there's no flux through your boundary.
You're assuming that your t is going to infinity on the boundaries? Because one of them is t is equal to zero, the other one is some...
So, exactly. So you evolve in time from t equals zero to some later time if there was no flux through infinity.
But couldn't there be flux in finite time but go to zero at infinity?
Flux at finite time.
So if you take the boundary in finite time, time slices of t equal to zero, t equal to 1,000 years, whatever.
And okay.
So I would say, okay, there's flux out there that is going out the boundaries, but at t equal to infinity, it might go to zero.
Okay. So then you would have, I see. Well, typically what you want is... Oh, then your charge would be globally conserved, right? But for a local observer, that wouldn't be very useful. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. But, you know, typically what you want to know is, right, let's say I have, I don't know, electromagnetic radiation in my space-time, right? And this radiation has been there for a long time. So the question is, you know, is the energy of this electromagnetic radiation conserved or something like that? Well, it is, as long as the radiation is kept inside the region, but doesn't go through the boundary to infinity or whatever, through the region which I measure, right?
Okay, so you make it as big as you want until there is no flux going out.
If you want. but you know, people consider also finite regions, right? So I'm interested, you know, how much radiation is in this room, right? And is the energy of this radiation conserved in this room? Well, it will be as long as it's not hitting the walls and not going away through the walls, right?
Another way of saying why this term vanishes, like because JMU has to be along n, and it would be like a space-like vector because we have made the boundary in such a way that b is along time direction. So if JMU has to be perpendicular to b, it will violate relativity.
Yeah. So it depends on what kind of boundary you have here. Right, and what is really the nature of the boundary? If I have really time-like boundary as I drawn it here, then yeah, what you want is that j mu and mu is equal to zero, right? And so that will be a sufficient condition for your thing not to have any flux boundary. Yes.
I'm a little bit confused on like. How we have like the normal setup. So on the bottom one, it's going up. Like, how do you choose that? Why is it going up on the top and up?
Oh, because I want, you know.
Because it's not like 90 degrees to the, like this way of the, like if the boundary's kind of going around.
Yeah, exactly. So no, if I did choose the normal down.
Which one? The top one?
The top one, uh-huh. Right? Then I would have a plus there, but then at the same time, let's see.
Oh, okay. Okay, so plus is pretty much like 90 degrees.
So my convention is like whenever the normal goes inside the region, it would be plus. It goes outside of the region, it's minus. So that's the convention I'm using. And you have to make, you know, one choice.
Oh, okay. So you can add up any of them as long. You just have the correct sign. So.
And then, you know, it doesn't matter, right? Everything is hiding in this sigma, whatever, right? So if I choose the normal going down, right? So then my n mu in the upper one would be minus 1, 0, 0, 0, right? And that would change the sign. So really, you just have to, you know, in order to calculate these integrals, you have to make lots of choices, mm-hmm. Right? But once you fix the choice, you'll find that this q is conserved.
I got it. Yeah, we're good. Thank you. That makes sense.
The way we did everything, that Q is a Lorentz scalar, but can it have like more indices?
Yes. Yes. We shall see that in a minute.
You said this is a covariant way of stating the charge conservation law. I don't, because the way we derive it and the way we state it, sigma refers to time, so it's a time-like slice. How do you change it to be just any hypersurface in your spacetime?
Oh, well, here I'm not really using the fact that it's a time-like slice, right? Well, I'm just, you know, composing things into the boundary and something, but you know, you can deform the surface sigma to whatever you want, and it will still give you the same thing, right? So.
So to see that, you just transform that.
So if I deform the surface like this, right, there's certainly no flux through this point here at the boundary. So whatever I calculate here on this slice will be the same as whatever I calculate on that slice. Right, so I can start deforming this the surfaces however I want. As long as there's no flux through this point, it will still be the same thing. Or I can even move it, you know, forward in time if you want to. As long as there's no flux through boundary, it's still the same thing. Right? So yeah, so it doesn't have to be, you can start deforming things.
What happens if the action includes the boundary term?
Aha, very good. So what do you think?
The charge would be conserved.
Uh-huh.
The amount of charge can be varied.
Uh-huh, exactly. So you know, adding boundary terms to the action actually will change your currents and will change your conserved charges. So we'll have effect.
Can I ask?
Yes. If you had some singularities, if you had some sources, so the charge wouldn't be conserved anymore, right? You are pumping the charge into the system through the source.
Right, in terms of residual and still like.
Yeah, exactly. So then you could. If you exclude the source again, I can draw a circle around it and exclude that, right? As long as there's no flux through that circle or whatever, then you are fine. If there is a flux through that circle, then again, that's your source for your charge, right? So and then the charge is no longer conserved.
Around the source, but if you just draw a contour around your source of charge, that's bound to be flux.
Yeah. Oh, what is the question? Yes. Yes. okay. Remark. So we now know how to actually formulate the conservation of charge completely covariantly without splitting into space and time. And so, you know, the charge and the currents are not unique. Current and charge not unique. Well, let's say current, just to simplify things, is not unique. And what you can do is that whenever you have conserved charge, conserved current, J mu, you can go to J mu plus psi mu nu, where this guy is antisymmetric in nu and nu. Oh no, what am I doing? sorry. J mu plus d nu psi nu mu. Well, this guy is antisymmetric in nu and nu. And so if this guy is conserved, d mu j mu equals to zero, then this thing here plus d mu d nu psi nu mu, well, this was zero by assumption. And this guy is, you have d mu and d nu, which is symmetric in mu and nu. And then you have nu mu, which is antisymmetric by assumption. So then this will be zero, symmetric times antisymmetric. So this is also zero.
Wait, why did we assume that?
So in other words, this would be your new conserved current. J tilde mu, also conserved. So that I can use this trick, that you know, d mu, d nu is symmetric. If this guy is antisymmetric, it automatically vanishes.
What kind of system would it like represent? Oh, it's just.
No, I'm just showing you that there is a freedom in JMU, right? So if I find one JMU which is conserved, satisfies d mu JMU equals to zero, then I can equally take another J tilde mu, which is given by this thing over here, and that will also be conserved, right? Yes.
So you said that if you put a charge in that an omega, you could just put a contour around it and just exclude it. But your time slices are not at infinity anymore. So if one says that there's flux, those time slices going out, how would you deal with that? Because I think the fluxes over the top and bottom boundary and the contours that you wrote around the charge, they will cancel each other, but not the time slices. Because you're assuming that at infinity they're going to be zero, but the contour, the small contour that you drew around the charge is not by definition at infinity.
Yeah. No, and there may be some flux, right? And there may be some flux, and you have to take that into account.
Yeah. So I mean, okay.
Well, imagine a laboratory, right? And then you have a dead rat, and that rat is closed in a small glass thing or whatever. So the virus is spreading from the dead rat. So as long as it's not spreading through the glass thing which you put, around that rat, then you are okay, and the virus is conserved in the laboratory, right? And it's zero. Right, but as long as it starts leaking through the through the glass, it will.
The boundary is not like a physical boundary. But like, what if you took that? What if you took these regions to be infinitesimally small and just like covered the space with them? If you wanted to, could you? You could still like kind of build this up from infinitesimally small regions, right? Is that not a way to do it?
I mean, I don't know why infinitesimally small, but yes, you could.
Just like tile it up, just tile the space with these things, and you can
put. Yeah, so, you know, once you start putting some holes in things and whatever, you can compose things, right? And then you have to exclude all the holes, and you have to do all these things. So yeah, you can make your region very complicated, and a complicated region will have more boundaries, and then you have to account for all of them and stuff like that.
But I mean, just like as opposed to saying it goes to infinity, if you instead use this proof, but for like. A finite region.
Yeah, that's fine.
You could tile the space with the finite region, then you're still proving the same thing for all.
Yeah. You can do it for finite region. Yes.
Can you also draw a contour like so the sides go to infinity for the charge, but the up and down are like.
I don't know why you're thinking that, but.
If you do this, you would say. On time is when it goes to infinity, you can say the flux that goes to infinity is zero and everything.
Sure. You know, if you choose your contour in such a way that you always kill the flux, then everything inside will be conserved. Yeah. So it may be useful or not. Depends, right? So anyway, what I was trying to say here is that if you have one conserved current, then there will be another conserved current, which is given by, you know, by adding this term here. So now does this miracle sine u mu or whatever that is, all that you need is that it is anti-symmetric in u and mu, but because it's useful, this guy here is called superpotential. Okay, and so to any current which is conserved, you can add the divergence of the superpotential. And then this thing will still be conserved.
Can this the superpotential term here be related to any of the terms in the definition of JMU there? Can we add it like in one of the two?
You mean here?
Yeah, there.
Yeah, if you want, I can still, I can always add this d mu psi mu nu, and that would be my. Yeah, you can do that.
Can we move with the energy momentum tensor?
Exactly. Yeah, that's what we will do. that's right. Right.
Also,
so yes.
How this will affect the charge?
What do you think?
I'm not sure. I think it should also change.
Yeah. It depends on what happens with that integral, right?
The same charge can be selected in such a way that it will die on the boundaries and it will be the same charge.
Yeah, let me postpone that question. I don't know. So we would have to check that. But I should know that. Yeah, but you know, it depends on how this integral is affected, right? All right, so we have that. Yes?
The superpotential freedom that we have on the current, is it disconnected from the gauge freedom that we have on the Lagrangian?
Yes. So the freedom in the Lagrangian will also change. Also change this current J mu, but I think that's not related to the superpotential, but I'm not sure.
You can't get the superpotential.
I don't think so. I don't think so. But I'm not sure 100%. But certainly, you know, if you exploit that freedom in the Lagrangian, that one here, that will have an effect on the current. Yeah. All right. So very good. So now let's take a look more at this canonical energy momentum tensor. So part C, canonical energy momentum tensor. So why is this interesting and important? Well, we have a beautiful formula here, given by this Noether's theorem. Well, if this is your change of space-time coordinates, and this is the change of your space-time fields, that's the corresponding current. OK, so let's consider the Poincaré translations. So consider space-time translations. In other words, I'm choosing delta tilde x mu to be epsilon mu, where epsilon mu is, you know, one, let's say epsilon one is 1 0 0 0. I'm just moving in time, or it's 0 1 1, or 0 1 0 0. I'm moving in x, or it's 0 0 1 0. I'm moving in y, whatever. So I have like four different epsilons here. Right, epsilon mu. So now your relativistic field theories, the fields are typically invariant on the space-time translation. Okay, so delta phi is equal to zero. So we're just moving everything in space and time, but the fields do not change. Okay, so in that case, if you look at your magic formula here, then delta tilde phi is equal to zero. And this is just epsilon nu, right? So then epsilon nu is a constant. It's a global symmetry. I'm just moving everything by constant epsilon. So in other words, you have now four conserved currents. So j mu, and we numerate them by this index nu to be equal to t mu nu canonical.
Wait, sorry, why is nu in parentheses? Special.
So this piece is gone. I have this piece is epsilon nu, right? So then I have j mu equals to t mu nu epsilon nu, and that's conserved, okay? But epsilon nu is just a constant. I can tear it away, and I will have four different currents for each epsilon. Or for epsilon nu, there's four epsilons, so for each epsilon, I will have a conserved current, okay? And that will be given by t mu nu. So this thing here satisfies d mu, j mu, this index I carry just with me, which is d mu, t mu nu equals to zero, right? So I have conservation of the canonical energy momentum tensor. Okay, so you can think about t mu nu, the canonical energy momentum tensor, as actually four currents, which I put in a matrix. And each of these currents is conserved separately.
I don't think I understand the label, like the parentheses nu.
Okay.
The epsilon go.
Very good. So you have that J mu, which was T mu nu, epsilon nu, was conserved, right? So we had that D mu, J mu of this thing here is conserved. But this epsilon nu does not play any role, right? So this is like D mu, T mu nu, but epsilon is a constant, right? So I can take it out. And this is equal to zero, right? So now I can choose this epsilon to be 1, 0, 0, 0. Okay, if I choose epsilon to be 1, 0, 0, what it gives me is that T mu 0 is equal to zero. Or I choose it equal to 0, 1, 0, 0, right? Then I will have T mu x equals to zero, right? And so on. So I'll have four conserved currents, right? Where I say that the conserved current here is just T mu nu, T mu, and I enumerate the current by the index nu. So this is just saying I'm considering that taking nu equal to T, I have one current which is conserved. Taking nu equal to x, I have another conserved current, and so on. So the T mu nu in this sense is just, you know, composition of four conserved currents, which I put in a matrix T.
So would you have to choose like these epsilon nu's for each of the four conserved currents? So you'd have to choose. Do they have to be like orthogonal or something?
But they will only be four independent, right? So yeah, I can do some combinations of these things, but there'll be only four independent. I can choose them, you know, and translate the time, or I translate in x, or in y, or in z, or whatever, right? So you have conservation of the canonical energy momentum tensor, and then we have the corresponding charges. So then we have four corresponding. So we have four currents. So we have four corresponding charges. Charges. And where is my formula how to calculate the charge? Oh, it's over there. So I would have one charge, which I call, okay. Okay, let me do it slowly, right? So I'll have Q. I take one of these, let's say T. Right, so it'll be integral over sigma T zero, and that will be J mu zero or T D sigma mu. So that will be one thing. It will be charge corresponding to the T direction.
Is it sum sign or integral sign?
Integral. Sorry. Integral J mu D sigma mu. Right. So that will be one charge. So this is an integral sigma T zero, T mu T D sigma mu, right? So there'll be one charge. And then I will have another charge where I choose this index to be x and index to be y and index to be z. So in the end, I have four charges, right? So I'll have QI as well. Is an integral sigma T zero J mu I E sigma mu, which is sigma T zero T mu I D sigma mu. Right? And so you have four conserved charges. These four conserved charges typically not called Q, but typically called P. And you can combine all of them together. And so we'll have P nu, which is the Q nu, which is an integral over sigma zero, and then T mu nu T sigma mu. Okay, so we have these four conserved charges, which come from the invariance of your field theory with respect to the space-time translation. Okay, So now what do we expect for these conserved charges? What do you think? What is the physical meaning of that?
Energy
and momentum, right? So this is, you know, the form momentum, which is conserved, or momentum. And we know that the form momentum has an energy, and it has the normal three momentum. So energy and the three momentum here. Conserved. Well, does it correspond to our intuition, what we know about the T mu nu? Well, the QT better be energy, OK? So it's given by the formula here, OK? So now, if I choose my normal again to be 1, 0, 0, okay. Again, choosing n mu to be 1, 0, 0, 0, then this is just an integral over dt d3x, okay? But it's a 0, 0 component of the energy momentum tensor. And if you've taken some special relativity course, or you'll see that that's precisely energy density. So this is what's called energy density. So now we integrate energy density over the volume, and you better get the total energy, right? And similarly here, you would see that, you know, this thing here, again, I choose the, so it would be TI, okay? And that corresponds to the energy flux or the energy momentum or whatever, right? So the structure of your T mu nu in general, so the T mu nu looks like you have energy density and you have the flux, E, energy flux, and then there's an energy flux here. That's one by one matrix. That's 1 by 3 matrix. That's a vector, right? And then, do you know what you would have over here? You can check that easily with your energy momentum tensor for electromagnetic field. You would have shears and pressures and stresses and stuff like that. So typically, you would have like pressure terms here. Okay, so that's the structure of T mu nu. In general, you have energy density, energy flux, and then something related to pressures in the 3 by 3 matrix here. Okay. So anyway, so we just got that we conserved the form momentum of the field, and the formula is given by here by integral of T mu nu. Okay, I have 5 minutes for 4 pages of calculations. So let me just tell you some buzzwords which you should know, and just be very, very careful when you talk about energy momentum tensor. And so what one misleading thing which I just told you here is that I draw this T mu nu in a way that it looks symmetric, right? It's like symmetric T mu nu. If I put T mu nu indices upstairs, right, up to a minus sign, whatever. So I'm drawing that this should be a symmetric tensor, T mu nu. So it's symmetric here. It's the same P here as the same P there. And the pressure part better be symmetric. OK, this never happens for the canonical energy momentum tensor. OK, the one which we constructed over here and which I gave you formula for is never symmetric unless you have just a scalar field theory. Okay, so if you have vectors, you have electromagnetism, or you have gravity, or anything else, then it won't be symmetric. So let's do final remarks. Remarks. T mu nu canonical is only symmetric. Metric for scalar field. So if you use the formula I gave you for the T mu nu canonical, then it won't be symmetric unless you have scalar field. Okay, and then what you can find is actually that the anti-symmetric part of this, you can find that the canonical mu nu, the anti-symmetric part of that, so I'm taking the anti-symmetric part of the mu nu, is given by the alpha as alpha mu nu. This is called spin tensor. Okay. So the spin tensor is something which is related to the spin of the field. So you know that the scalar field does not carry any spin. It's a spin zero thing. So this guy will be zero for scalar field. And so then anti-symmetric part of T mu nu canonical is zero. And then the T mu nu is symmetric. Okay? But if you have a vector field, Maxwell field, right, then it carries spin one. And this S will be non-trivial. And the canonical energy momentum tensor which constructs through Noether's procedure will have anti-symmetric part. Okay, so it won't be symmetric. Okay, so that's one remark. However, what you can do is that if theory is invariant under Lorentz transformations, which always is, okay, then you can actually add to your T mu nu is a way how to upgrade your T mu nu from T mu nu canonical to some better T mu nu, which is already symmetric. Then we can upgrade T mu nu to be symmetric. And the way you do it is that you do from T mu nu canonical to T mu rho, which is the new one, which is given by the old one, plus that's stupid, mu, okay, over here. Okay, so we haven't done anything here. What we have done is that we've added the superpotential, right? So in the same way as we could have added to a superpotential to any of the conserved currents, so now our conserved current has an extra index rho, right? That enumerates our currents. Yes.
Also anti-symmetric like it was before.
Yeah.
Exactly. It has to be again. So what you again want is that the d mu of t mu rho is equal to zero. So this was originally equal to zero. Then if this guy is anti-symmetric in nu and mu, it's still the same superpotential, right? Still this guy has to be anti-symmetric in nu and mu. The only difference is that it now carries an extra index rho because this guy carries an extra index rho. I'm past time. Okay, so to be super, symmetric, if we are adding the superpotential, and this superpotential is given by C mu nu rho is 1/2 times the spin tensor, S nu mu rho minus S mu nu rho plus S rho mu nu. Okay, so if you find the spin tensor for your theory, which corresponds somehow to the internal angular momentum of your field theory, then you can find the corresponding superpotential like that. And if you upgrade your canonical energy momentum tensor by the superpotential, this guy already will be symmetric. Okay, so you can upgrade that. Moreover, if your theory is conformally invariant, then you can upgrade your TMU nu so that it can be traceless. Okay, if also conformal invariants, then you can upgrade again, so that you have TMU nu, which is symmetric, but also TMU nu, which is traceless. Okay, that's the right energy momentum tensor you want to think about, for example, for Maxwell's theory. You want a symmetric TMU nu, which is moreover traceless. But you have to upgrade it twice. You have to upgrade it by, you know, subtracting or whatever the superpotential corresponding to the internal angular momentum that kills the antisymmetric part. But you also have to kill the trace of TMU nu by doing some dilatations and whatever, and the corresponding superpotential by dilatation current. Okay, and that gives you finally the right energy momentum tensor to think about for the Maxwell theory. Okay, there's a much shorter way. You can get this in general relativity in two lines. The energy momentum tensor, which you get by varying the Lagrangian with respect to G mu nu, that's an energy momentum tensor. That will be for Maxwell theory automatically traceless, automatically symmetric, because metric is automatically symmetric. So then these two will sort of agree. This one is called Rosenfeld's energy momentum tensor. This one is called improved canonical energy momentum tensor. And they do agree if you do all these upgrades here. This is the one which couples to gravity. There's no way the gravitational one would have antisymmetric part. We don't know how to do that. Gravitational field always couples to symmetric thing, right? And that's the right energy momentum tensor. So you know, in general relativity, it would be another procedure to find this TMU nu, much nicer than the canonical. Let me stop here. Yes?
How does this superpotential relate to the previous one? Is it just a contraction over rho? Can we define it like that, right?
So
that we showed earlier.
You just carry that extra index rho, yeah. Right? So this is the superpotential, right? So we had j mu. We went from j mu to j mu plus d nu psi nu mu, where this was antisymmetric. So all I'm doing is that I'm putting an extra index here.
Okay.
Right? So I just carry. I am combining four currents together, right? So I carry extra index rho. No. So you know, the superpotential, you can always do that, right? I can always add the superpotential here. I'm not doing anything important or whatever. But you know, sometimes there's a nice choice of the superpotential, which you know, causes that the resulting current has desirable properties, some nice properties. Okay. In general, you don't know how to construct this superpotential. But sometimes you do. And you know, if your theory has extra symmetries, like it has Lorentz invariant symmetry or whatever, then you know that this is your prescription for the superpotential, which makes it symmetric, for example, the TMU nu. Okay, so sometimes you know there's a preferable choice of your superpotential so that your resulting TMU nu has some nice property.